Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Rapido, what we're going to be doing today, I believe, is one-time sensitive important announcement. And then we're going to do some housekeeping.
Yeah,
we'll see
what happens after that. But listeners, the most important thing to note is if you're a party person, the next 12 minutes are going to be very important to you in planning your party life. Because the best party of the year you'll ever go to is on Cleveland, Ohio on the 13th of June, and here's all about it.
Some listeners may know that Pittsburgh, from which On the Menu Radio broadcasts, has something of a rivalry with the lakeside city of Cleveland, just about 130 miles away, and it's very difficult for us in Pittsburgh to say great things come out of Cleveland. But believe me, every 2 years they do, with the world's most amazing party called Five Star Sensation. On the Menu was there 2 years ago at this wonderful event, and we're getting ready to go again, and we thought you absolutely must know about this and must make your plans if you have the chance to do that. So we have Laurie Vick, who is with the University Hospitals of Cleveland, which is beneficiary of the proceeds of this great event. Laurie, welcome to On the Menu. Give us a snapshot of this great event.
Oh, I'm happy to do so and really pleased to talk with you and again this year. Peter, it was delightful to have you visit, and we're so pleased that you're going to be coming back again this year. And the Five Star Sensation has been an event that's been going on biennially since 1987, and it truly is a culinary extravaganza, huge celebration of food and wine that benefits all the proceeds, as you mentioned, do benefit University Hospitals, Ireland Cancer Center, and these funds go toward research and education. Since the event started, we've raised more than $10 million for research, and it stays right here at the Ireland Cancer Center. In 2007, $2 million in this one evening. And why do people come out for this? Because, as you said, it is the biggest and best party ever. Chef to the Stars Wolfgang Puck invites 70 of his closest friends in the chefing and vintner world to come to Cleveland under one huge, gigantic tent roof and cook up all of their specialties. And it truly is an event that you remember gastronomically and you feel good about because you're doing such great things for the world of cancer research.
Now, the most amazing thing that we found is that there's a very large crowd. You don't raise $2 million without having quite a lot of people come. And,
yes.
And yet there's plenty of room. You don't feel crushed. There's a place for every person to sit down. So after you strolled around the different restaurants in the strolling supper party format, you get your food and you have a wonderful place to sit down and enjoy with wine without haste and without hustle and bustle. So that's an amazing thing.
Absolutely. And as you said, there are 2,000 guests were there in 2007, and we are hoping to reach that number this year, and we are well on our way. The tent, we call it a tent, but it is over the size of a football field. So it's pretty huge and can accommodate everyone comfortably.
Everybody looks good, too. It's black tie. Hmm?
Well, actually, we like to call it sensationally casual.
Oh, okay.
So the ladies fun with the colors and...
Don't you remember last time?
You wore shorts. I remember exactly.
Last year, I was very trendy. I wore a trendy jacket and shorts.
You did, and I think people caught on, and we might see more of that this year.
There you go. In that case, I got a surprise. I'm going to do something different. But before we get too carried away, Laurie, let's make sure we get the information out in the interview about where people can find out more and get their tickets.
Absolutely. The event is Saturday, June 13th at 7 p.m., and it is in Cleveland, Ohio, actually in the suburb of Beechwood, on the site of our future University Hospitals Ahuja Medical Center, a new hospital that we are building. And for more information, folks can visit the five-star website, which is fivestarsensation.org. Simple to remember, and tickets are still available. They are priced at $300, $600, and $1,000, and you can get more information by visiting the website.
Great. And now we're going to put up a news item about it as well as soon as we get this show produced, which is the most important priority because it's going to air on Sunday, so we better make sure it's ready. Now, Laurie very kindly arranged for us to have on the line, and he's on the line with us now, Luciano Pellegrini, from Valentino Restaurant in Las Vegas, who's one of Chef Wolfgang Puck's 70 best buddies. Luciana, first of all.
One of them, yeah.
First of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And briefly, Luciana, you started out at Valentino in Santa Monica. And then we met you a few years ago when you won a James Beard Award, and you told us the story of how you'd moved from there to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there to this day, and the restaurant's also called Valentino.
Yes, it is the second Valentino we opened. Valentino in Santa Monica was founded about 36 years ago by Piero Selvaggio, who has been and still is one of the most prominent figures in Italian restaurants and Italian cuisine. He was sort of the pioneer of fine dining Italian, which, you know, to some sounds like an oxymoron.
Oh, no.
You know, Italian and fine dining, but it can be done, actually. And we moved to Las Vegas back in 1999. He offered me a position here as the executive chef and made me a partner. And 10 years after that, actually, this year is our 10th year anniversary. We are actually going to open another Valentino, a third store in Houston, Texas.
Really? Oh, yes. That's good news.
Okay, but you must be a pretty mean fine dining Italian chef to be made a partner in a new venture. So that's quite a
I've been with Piero for the better part of 24 years now. I moved here in 1985, and I've been with him ever since. And I do believe that when we moved to Las Vegas, he was told by some advisor that it was a very competitive market, and where chefs that were worth, you know, a little bit of their salt, so to speak, would have been snatched up in a heartbeat if you didn't keep them, you know, nice and tight. And I guess that kind of gave him the motivation to best me as a partner.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, 6 months after moving here, you know, somebody had proposed me a deal, restaurant and position as executive chef and possible ownership and whatnot. And I stayed loyal to Piero, and I guess, you know, I'm a person that values certain qualities over others and doesn't just goes with the flow or doesn't follow, you know, the easterly wind or stuff like that. And, you know, it's been a successful working relationship for the better part of 24 years. As with all relationships, you have, you know, highs and lows and good moments and not so good moments, but, you know, the important part is to just move forward.
Well, it's an Italian thing, right? The family and the
that too. I mean, you know, you got loyalty and you have kinship and and, you know, I guess everybody, you know, sticks to their own kind to a degree or another. Not that we like to think of it that way, but, you know, it sure looks that way.
Well, now, do you know any of the other chefs coming?
Do I know them?
Who's coming?
If you were to ask me, I couldn't tell you who they were, but I know them all. I actually have been going to Cleveland for the past 20 years.
Oh, wow.
I do believe this is my 10th five-star event, and it's always a great party, I would say.
Now, why do you go? Do you go because it's a great party, or do you go because it's a good cause? I mean, what is the reason?
Well, absolutely. Since we are on the radio, I do go because it is a worthy cause and not because of the party. No, just kidding.
Well, I mean, this is
it definitely begins with friends asking you, you know, would you be part of something great? And, of course, you say absolutely, and then things grow on you. And I have to say that Cleveland has become a city that I appreciate, that I kind of enjoy going every 2 years.
Oh, great.
And they do put together a great, great event, and the people there are delightful and they're appreciative, and they always make us feel like rock stars.
Yeah, there you go. That's a nice. Now, one of the other things that's really great about this party is the kitchen facilities they have for you there, right? Because it's almost as good as being in your own kitchen.
Sort of. I mean, they have a great base camp at Cleveland Stadium. You know, we use their facility there for prepping purposes, and you have a number of associated and affiliated restaurants that, you know, make their space available if anybody needs, you know, to work in a smaller space. And pretty much they rent anything that you might possibly think you need. And so everybody comes in and they prepare a dish or two, and they think, you know, what do I need? And basically they just prepared that for you. So
now, what are you going to make?
Fryers and whatnot.
What will you bring?
What am I going to make? I usually present the whole menu from appetizers to middle course to entree and dessert. And one of the main player of five-star Carol Carr is fell in love with this dish that I make, a grilled pizza. About 15 years ago, and she just doesn't let me not make it.
Yeah, we interviewed Carol last year.
I got to the point where this year I submitted the menu and I did not put grilled pizza in it, and then I talked to her yesterday and I said, you know, I was playing a joke on you and you didn't even pick up on it. But of course, I will do grilled pizza just because she insists, and then I'm going to do a classic dish called vitello tonnato, and it's roasted veal loin. Thinly sliced with a tuna caper anchovy sauce, which is delightful.
It's wonderful.
Then we're going to serve a pasta dish. We're going to do some spinach and ricotta cannelloni, so fresh pasta cut into squares. I'm going to do a spinach and ricotta stuffing. I'm going to put some fresh tomato sauce over the top, bake them off, little parmesan cheese, simple and easy. And then we're going to do some grilled American Kobe beef bracciolini. Bracciolini
are
thinly pounded pieces of beef. And then we flavor those with a little pancetta, a little sage, a little flavorings, and then we just roll them up and put them in skewers and then cook them on a grill.
I have the feeling that I'm going to spend the whole evening parked in front of your place.
And to finish off, we're going to offer all candied pineapple and vanilla panna cotta.
Wow.
So we've got a little bit of the savory, we got a little bit of meat, and then, you know, if anybody's vegetarian, we'll give them a little pasta, so a little bit for everybody.
Oh, boy, that's only one, listeners, only one of the... And how many chefs are there?
How many am I bringing?
No, how many chefs are invited?
I don't know, I think I heard, 70, Laurie?
And I can answer, there are 35 chefs
35
and 40
chefs.
Vintners.
Okay.
And I do have the list of the chefs, and... I'll tell you what, when Luciano is explaining everything he's making, go, oh my goodness, multiply that by 35.
And that's what I'm thinking.
But you asked before some of the other chefs who might be there, and I can rattle off a couple of them for you.
Please do, yes.
Top of my head, Ricky Estrellato from Nobu in New York is going to be there.
Oh, that's cool.
Sam Choi's Diamond Head restaurant from Honolulu is sending Joseph DeSimone. Let's see, we've got Gino Angelini from Angelini Osteria in Los Angeles. Andrew Kirshner from Wilshire Restaurant in Santa Monica. Carrie Heffernan from Southgate in New York. Gordon Hammersley from Hammersley's Bistro.
Yeah, he's a friend, yeah.
Boston, yeah. And Lydia Shire also coming in.
Oh, Lydia's good, yeah. Great.
And let's see, Frank Ostini from The Hitching Post. And on and on and on.
Oh, and
again, you know, your listeners can visit the website and get the full list of all of the chefs and the vintners who'll be there.
And, you know, I mean, I guess I have to say that the one thing that's really amazing is the sheer generosity of all the chefs and the vintners as well.
Oh, it is incredible. Yeah. And when Luciano says we treat them like rock stars, it's because they are. It is incredible the amount of work that it takes to put this together and on their part and coming in here and from out of town and you know, the tremendous donation of time and of course their talents and the food they prepare, and it's just an extraordinary generosity. We couldn't be more grateful.
Well, On the Menu steers you wrong very rarely, listeners, as you know, and believe me, this is the best party we ever went to. We know it's going to be the same this year, so you'll be foolish if you're not there.
And I bought something new to wear.
There we go. She did indeed. And so, Laurie and Luciano, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you a week from Saturday in Cleveland.
Be my pleasure.
Okay, Luciano.
We'll see you then.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Grazie mille.
Arrivederci.
So, as they used to say, be there or be square. And now, I think it's time to...
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Email us, please, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Or check into onthemenuradio.blogspot.com or follow me on Twitter, OTM Dish,
or follow me on Facebook. Well, you get the idea.
this lady's absolutely everywhere.
I'm everywhere. And we have another young lady coming up now who is absolutely everywhere. She's turned her, at such a young age, she's sort of turned her her habit for blogging into, she's practically a rock star at this point.
And
Molly
Wisenberg. Molly Wisenberg, and you're going to find
AKA
out...
AKA Georgette. Orangette,
and you're going to find out her story because she just wrote it in a very interesting book.
Molly Wisenberg is really, she's not an overnight sensation. She's been around for a while, even though she's quite young. She's the creator of a wonderful food blog called Orangette. Molly, welcome. Give us a little bit of your background, because the book is, in essence, it's recipes, but it's really mainly your story, your life.
Yeah.
So how did you get here?
Well, I grew up in a family of avid home cooks, and I was just telling someone the other day that it was really sort of, you know, the air that we breathe and the water that we swim in. I think I had no idea that, but not all families were that way. And so to me, the way that I spent time with the people that were close to me, and the way that I spent time with friends or family was around food. And it took me a long time to really sort of figure out how to put food in its right place in my life. I think it was always very important to me, but I never quite knew what to do with it. And just cooking for myself at the end of the day was never quite enough. I wanted to be doing something more with it. And it really took me a long time. It took me until about 5 years ago to sort of push aside some of the other things that I had been trying to do, like going to graduate school and thinking I might be a professor someday, that kind of thing. I was very interested in what I was studying, but it was never as meaningful to me as food. And it really, it was when I decided to leave graduate school that I decided to start Orangette as a way of kind of trying to figure out how to bring food and writing, which I had always loved as well.
Your writing is, I mean, you just have this natural talent that, I was just so impressed with how everything seems so effortless, as I said to you, but although as a writer I know this is not the case. You always had this idea, you realized you had this great talent?
I've always loved to write, and it was kind of the way that I always made sense of things. And I think I was really lucky as a kid to have teachers who really encouraged me in it, and
from an early age too.
Interesting things to read. Yeah, definitely from an early age. I really had teachers who told me about summer programs in writing and in poetry, all kinds of things, and really encouraged me to go after it. And I think that it was something that they kind of empowered me to feel that I could do it. But at the same time, you know, as you said, it's still a lot of, it's a huge amount of work, and there are many days that I would rather be doing anything but writing. But when I sit down and do it, it feels like what I'm supposed to be doing.
Reviewers have compared you to MFK Fisher. Now, that has to be heady stuff for a 30-year-old.
That is heady stuff.
Oops,
and I just
oops,
try
you let
not
the
to
you let the secret out. dear. if you don't behave, I'll tell people how old you are.
I love MFK Fisher's writings. Her book, The Gastronomical Me, is really a touchstone for me, and I think it's the first real food writing that I read, and obviously one that I've come back to many times. So, you know, when somebody says that kind of thing about me, I am so grateful, but I think it would just paralyze me if I sat around and thought about whether or not it was true, you know?
Right.
So I say thank you, and I get back to work.
Now, let's go back to talking a little bit more about the structure of the book, because you said it's about how people connect via food, but it's a very personal story as well at the same time. So it's not generically about whether Italians are more hospitable and
right.
than the French or the English, who are obviously not very hospitable at all. but in your case, it had to do with a seriously small subset of that called the Wisenberg family.
Yes. Yeah, for me, you know, I grew up in a household where my dad, really the way that he unwound at the end of the day, and he was a physician and he treated cancer patients, so he had a pretty stressful work life. The way that he unwound was by cooking, and he was the main cook in the house, and my mother cooked as well, and very well, but she was kind of more of the baker, which is really how I am in my own marriage now. My husband is sort of more of the savory cook, and I'm more of the sweet type. But I really grew up with this sense that, you know, we didn't really cook any particular food from any place or, you know, my father grew up in a Polish family or family of Polish immigrants in Toronto, and I really, you know, he never cooked for me the kind of food that they ate. We kind of cooked, we were kind of, I guess, recreating, you know, we were making our own way, really, making the foods that were meaningful to us in the place where we lived.
Which is in the heartland.
The time that I was growing up, yeah. So, I grew up in Oklahoma, and...
Can't get more heartland than that.
yeah, pretty much the middle of it all.
Yeah, we were in Kansas City briefly.
Yeah, well, I grew up with wonderful beef in Oklahoma,
yeah.
And so we really cooked pretty simply. I mean, I also grew up in the 80s, which was during sort of the big low-fat pasta craze when everyone was very into eating pastas and low-fat cooking. And so, you know, I feel almost more a product of a time period than of a particular place, really.
Well, now, this story carries us through your growing up, and it carries through your father's diagnosis and then a death from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the thing that really tore me up was the chapter on the modeling.
Yeah.
Because I went through that with my mother.
Uh-huh.
And nobody had told me that that's what it meant.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing to see when
I didn't know, nobody ever said that to me. And I mean, I noticed it, but I didn't know what it meant.
Right.
Yeah. And then you move on to other times. The story about how you met your husband was totally fascinating.
Yeah, I met him because he was a reader of my blog. He sent me an email in April of 2005. It was, I guess, about 8 months after I had started the blog, 8 or 9 months. And he said that a friend of his had been doing an internet search for a lemon cake recipe and had found my site.
Mm-hmm.
And she had told him about it, and he started reading. And so he sent me this email to tell me that he really liked the site, and he mentioned that he was a musician, and he lived in New York. And he said, you know, it's too bad. You're in the wrong city. If you were here in New York, I would love to take you to Balthazar for a martini.
Yeah.
And, for whatever
here you go.
Reason.
This is like, so Meg Ryan will play you and Tom Hanks will play him when they make the movie.
That's true. I mean, we could do Sleepless in Seattle all over again. Since,
I know.
I was living in Seattle.
I was thinking if You Got Mail.
Yes.
Yeah, but go ahead. So you loved Balthazar and you went to New York to have a drink with him, right?
So I actually, what happened was he came to Seattle first.
Oh, okay.
We emailed back and forth a number of times, and eventually I gave him my phone number because after, you know, maybe 2 weeks of this, I thought, what if this is some teenager playing this elaborate trick on me? I got very nervous, and I gave him my phone number, and really out of the blue, less than a week after he and I spoke on the phone for the first time, his father told him that he was coming to Seattle on a business trip,
and
he offered Brandon a companion ticket. And so Brandon flew out to Seattle and met me, and that was, I guess, almost 3 weeks to the day after the first email.
What a romantic story.
Yeah, and then, you know, we spent the next year or so sort of trading off, going back and forth to see each other, and then he moved to Seattle.
Now, in terms of the, before I move on, I mean, I thought, I never understood why that guy stopped calling you in Paris.
Oh,
you see, I got really into this book, and listeners, you'll find so many parallels. I mean, I did, and actually, I have a son who's 30, so anyhow, how does this, I don't know quite how to ask this. I mean, you don't separate the autobiographical material from the use of this as a cookbook. Do you expect people to use it both ways, as a good read and as a cookbook?
I hope that they will. I know when I read food memoirs, I will very often fold down at least, you know, a few pages of recipes. I think that naturally, you know, I think that because food is a way of making sense of our lives and making sense of our relationships, I think for me, naturally, these things go together, autobiography or memoir and recipes. And so I hope that people will cook from the book a little bit. Yeah, definitely.
Now, how will you go from here? You've told your life story already. What are you going to write about next?
Well, she's going to have more life.
I've got to get busy. I guess I've got to get busy living and making more stories now.
We might mention you also contribute to Bon Appetit.
I write a monthly column for them called Cooking Life, and I've been writing it since February of 2008, so that has been really fun. But as far as what I plan to do next, you know, for now, I feel very focused on a restaurant that my husband and I are opening together in Seattle.
What? Tell us about this.
Yeah, we are opening a restaurant called Delancey, named for the street in New York, and it's going to be in the Ballard neighborhood in Seattle, and it's focused on New York-inspired pizza. My husband is originally from New Jersey and was, of course, living in New York when I met him, and the man is obsessed with pizza, and he really wants to make the pizza make pizza at least that's inspired by what he grew up eating. And so it's not going to be just solely a pizzeria in the sense of, you know, come get a slice and a beer. It's also going to be a full-service restaurant with all kinds of unusual salads and rustic desserts. We're trying really to make the restaurant that we want to eat in. And so that's what's next on the docket for me. We're hoping to open this summer, or we will open this summer, just not sure the exact date.
Well, you must let us know when you're doing that so that we can bring you back on the show, and perhaps we can bring Mr. Wright along as well.
Oh, he would love.
I don't know whether his name's Weisenberg or not. That's why I said. We'll just call him Mr. Wright.
His name is Brandon Pettit.
Okay, Brad. Well, we wish Brandon Pettit good luck on the air. We wish you good luck as well, Molly. And I think there might be a book in How to Open a Restaurant.
Maybe so. We'll see.
I'm sure there must be one in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm taking lots of pictures and, you know, trying to write down anything interesting that we stumble across along the way in case I do want to write about it later.
Well, it's a wonderful book. It's a fascinating story. I'm sure
it's a heartwarming book,
yeah,
too.
Opening the restaurant sounds like another exciting new adventure, and went through that personally once, so she didn't write a book about it because she couldn't...
I couldn't get past the pain.
Every time she tried, the tears kept washing the ink off the page. So we hope that your story has a happier ending, and thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Great talking to you, Molly. Thank you
for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. We said earlier in the program we were doing a little bit of housekeeping this week. I guess you could call it house cleaning, because several very interesting interviews sort of found their way into the corner of the cupboard, and we thought we ought to bring them to you because they were guests that we really want to share. And first up now is a fascinating little guidebook about the City of London. Peter and Anne think they know quite a lot about London because they're regular visitors. There's a lot in this book that we didn't know. It's part of a very charming series of books called, what are they called?
Little Books.
Little Books. Of course, you can buy it on our website as well. But here's a guidebook for those of you who don't know London well and would like to know it better. And you can hear about what it's all about and why. Oh, yeah, do it on a budget too. That's
something.
That's something, and it's hard. But here are some of the secrets in this book.
Elaine Louis was explaining to us how she came to write Savoir Fair London, Stylish Dining for Under $25. Elaine, welcome to On the Menu. Now, Elaine is a staff writer contributing to the dining section on the New York Times, and she's been in the business for a while. Explain to us the cute little story behind, and I might say cute little, this is the most adorable book. It's called The Little Book. Publishing, is it?
Called The Little Book Room.
The Little Book Room.
I promised an interesting little segue into the story of the London School of Economics, because in 1960, there was a very famous headline in the London School of Economics student newspaper saying, LSE boy makes good. and the LSE boy in question was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. So your daughter was following in some fairly important footsteps.
Yeah. You could also say it was Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Oh, was Jagger there too? He probably didn't finish.
Monica Lewinsky got a graduate.
That's true. That's
well,
right.
Everybody's standards are falling.
Well, let's back up and tell us the story about how it was born, this book, which is adorable, of necessity.
In September 2007, my daughter was entering London School of Economics, and she wanted to eat at Bombay Brasserie, a really beautiful Indian restaurant in London. And so we went, and she ordered lentils, and I ordered a soft-shell crab and some breads and two glasses of wine. And the bill came to $120, and I nearly passed out because, as I said to my daughter, Anna, I said, lentils feed the poor of the world, and for us to spend $60 for your plate of lentils is nuts. And so we must get a grip on ourselves. And then I made another fatal error. One night I decided I had to have Shanghai soupy dumplings because I hadn't had them in several weeks. And we went to a famous Chinese restaurant that Time Out said had the best soupy dumplings in town. And they were $30 for six of them.
It sounds like Hackensack.
Yeah.
Hackasan.
Oh, No,
it wasn't Hackensack.
It was something called Royal China or something like that.
Well, anyway, it didn't make the cut in your book.
Oh, no. And so that's when I came back to New York, I mentioned to Angela Hederman, who is the editor and publisher and founder of the Little Book Room, could we do a book on eating stylishly in London for under $25? Because while I was in London, I was covering the design fair, and I met a lot of really talented architects who took me to lunch, or we went to dinner, at perfectly delicious, normal price, meaning they could eat lunch for 25 or under, or even dinner. And so Angela said yes, and so I brainstormed with all these terrific gallerists and designers, like Peter Ting and Libby Sellers, and restaurants that were cross-referenced, that more than one person brought up. I decided those were the ones that I should go to. And so I went back in the spring of 2008, and did the book my daughter.
Yeah, we were actually there at the same time, because we were in London in April of 2008, but
right.
we were not focusing on places where you could dine for $25 and under. although there is some crossover. I noticed Roast to Go and Roast up on the first floor above the Borough Market is one of our absolute favorite places. In fact, we were there this year on Valentine's Day.
Right.
Oh, great.
Yeah, their oysters are great too. But anyhow, some of these we've been to. So we just discovered that you included Thomas Cubitt.
The Thomas Cubitt.
And what are some of the other ones that we've been to?
It's Elaine's book. Why don't we get her to talk through? Because you're in different geography, so you cover the city in different places, but you've also got a variety of different styles of places, I think.
Well, what I thought was most interesting is that London is a much more multi-ethnic food restaurant place than it was, say, 10 years ago when I was last there, and where it was really you had Indian food and a little bit of Chinese, but you didn't have everything. You didn't have Spanish. The Spanish food seems to be the thing of the moment. Tapas in London, and you didn't have a lot of Turkish food or a lot of Lebanese food, and there seems to be much more of a terrific mixture there. I thought some of the more interesting ones were the ones that were hardest to find, which is, say, the Rochelle Can, which is Margot.
I finally figured that out. We met Margot in Melbourne at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival in 2008, and she said she was a chef, and I said, where did you work? And she said, canteen, but she forgot to mention the Rochelle part of it.
Oh, so that's what
there is a restaurant called Canteen.
Oh, I think it's fun.
Which is not where she works.
Yeah, I think it's fun to have to go and search these things out. I mean, that one is hard to find and completely delightful, and she has that wonderful bread. And everything does is just perfect. Like I took a bite of a sandwich that was just bread and chutney and brie, and it was just a fabulous, good, she said, typical, traditional British thing. But the bread was so good, and the cheese was perfect, and the chutney was perfect. And there was this lovely, fresh thing. You don't get the sense that traditional British food is necessarily stuffy at all. It's very, very yummy.
Oh, let me assure you that there is British food is gruesome. Let's put it as grim. I think to my mother-in-law's cooking.
Yeah, I think that's not entirely fair. I think what's happened is people are preparing traditional British foods with a lot more care.
Yeah.
As a result, they may be the same thing, but the ingredient is better quality,
and
the preparation is a lot more careful. I had oxtail pudding.
Yeah, that was
at a restaurant owned by Sam and Eddie Hart, whose Barrafina makes it into your book, but whose Quo Vadis probably didn't because it wasn't open by then, but it certainly doesn't meet the price point.
Right.
But they're making an old-fashioned suet pudding.
Now, yeah, I'm not saying that there's something basically wrong with British style food, but it certainly needed considerable invigoration.
Oh yes, yes, and the other thing that was definitely true is that even in restaurants it was badly cooked. So good traditional ingredients, well cooked, makes an interesting part of the diet. Now you have quite a lot of, I guess I'd call them cake and coffee shops in there too.
I had put a few in, right.
That's cheating, Elaine.
Oh. I don't actually have a sweet tooth, but I think people do.
I don't either.
And people like snacks, and so we thought that we could include a few of them, like the very famous Maison Berthaud and Bees of Bloomsbury, who had just opened, because she serves savories too. Maison Berthaud serves only, you know, two savories, you know, croissant with ham and cheese and, you know, the pizza à l'air. But it's such a cute place.
How did the Wolseley get in here? I'm just hit
that one. For breakfast only.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you've got to go there for breakfast now.
Everyone tells us that it's not going to work at all for lunch and for dinner, but for breakfast. And I had the rashers and something or other, and it was, you know, $17, and it was huge. Uh-huh. You know, it could have fed three people.
Yeah,
so
that is breakfast.
Well, the traditional English breakfast, or the traditional Irish breakfast, as they call it when they take it across the North Sea, is an enormous number of calories, an enormous quantity of fat,
right.
and a great bargain. I mean, that
yep.
Most everywhere that would come in easily under your $25 mark. Now,
right.
It's interesting. You put everything into dollars. Do you think that makes it confusing for people when they see the prices on the menu in pounds, or
No, because it's being sold. We give the conversion at the beginning that it was written in May of 2008, and at this time the conversion rate was straight to American dollars to a pound.
So it's a huge.
And when they go there, they'll know the conversion rate.
Right,
anything that's in the book, I think, assuming that. I don't know that London restaurants are quite as fickle as New York, but assuming that they're all still in business, the prices would still work in this parameter, and in fact probably
better,
a bit lower.
Yeah. Yeah, you could probably afford a glass of wine in the currency conversion improvement.
Right.
You certainly wouldn't be able to fit a glass of wine into your $25.
One of the things I thought was really impressive about the chefs there is that they really do locally source their ingredients.
Oh, yeah, they do, don't they?
And know the farmers, and know the fishermen, and they know their butchers, and so they use the word traceable, which Americans don't use. But I thought that was great, and that really showed alertness.
Curiously enough, part of that was a product of the bovine encephalo, whatever the hell it was,
mad
cow disease thing.
Oh, the mad cow disease.
Because people started, in fact, shopping in places where there was traceability. My mother always said she'd always done that.
Yeah, we never cut back on any of the meat.
So we never avoided British beef and lamb at all when we were in England, because we knew that most restaurants had sourced it properly.
But
there is a movement in that direction, and we got involved with someone who was really quite extreme in that movement.
You're talking
in London
about
a place called Constam at the Prince Albert.
They don't
shop outside of a ring of 25 miles outside of London at all. They just refuse to have any ingredients.
You should check that one out back.
I suspect they might cheat on their olive oil if they use that, but, but other than that, they don't. I was surprised that one chain that we're familiar with was missing. That's called Leon.
People mentioned Leon to me. They said their salads were great, but I somehow couldn't get that excited about a salad at once. So I skipped, and I threw in Carluccio's. I try not to put in too many chains, but I did put in Carluccio's. I think why? I like the freshness. The fresh look of the place. That's all. I like the look of it, and that it's like basically decent food.
Thank goodness you also.
Astonishing, but it's decent.
Thank goodness you also left out McDonald's, and you left out.
I did.
You left out Pret a Manger.
But a lot of designers and architects said they do humble in a Carluccio.
Uh-huh.
You know, now and then.
Yeah.
And, you know, for very simple things, and it struck me as being really okay.
Now, will you be using this as a stepping stone to do a similar book for another city when your daughter goes to graduate school in Paris or Rome or wherever she goes?
You know, I mentioned it to my editor to do Shanghai and Beijing in one. In one book.
Oh,
you know,
good luck.
But the economy is so weird right now.
Oh, yeah.
That I think she's shifting, everyone's shifting in terms of what they're going to post.
Is she in the Far East?
Who, my daughter?
Yeah.
No, my daughter is currently in Beirut. She's the arts and culture editor of the Daily Star, the English language paper of Lebanon.
Wow.
So you were just thinking that the savoir faire Shanghai might
well,
be a
I'm
good
Chinese.
How are you really?
I'm Chinese, and I don't speak the language, but I know a lot about Chinese food, and I co-wrote the Shunli cookbook with Michael Tong here in New York City.
Oh.
And I've been
is
to
that
Shanghai.
The Tong that we know?
Shunli here.
Isn't there a restaurant called Tong?
No.
Not that I'm familiar with.
In London?
Well, Kai. No, that's China Tang.
Tang, I'm sorry.
T-A-N-G, which comes in around a single order of magnitude higher than your upper level. and not only that, it's in pounds. Truth to tell, listeners, as you have found out for yourself, if you've been to London as frequently as we have, Elaine's work is a great contribution here to being able to eat on something more like a budget than on the menu typically does, and it's going to become a treasured possession for us when we go back next time. And Elaine, it was just such a pleasure to have you join us on the menu. And
are you an expert in Asian food or Chinese food?
I'm knowledgeable about food. I have a current column in the dining section called The Temporary Vegetarian.
Oh, okay, right.
And I won the James Beard Award for a series of articles on ethnic neighborhoods in New York City, all five boroughs, which I did in 1995.
You're nothing if not ambitious.
No, I just love food. I will eat almost anything.
Really?
Except a soft-boiled egg.
A what?
Soft-boiled eggs.
You don't like those?
I don't know.
I have those almost every morning.
it's also fashionable not to like beets, but that's another story.
Poor old Dharma. So anyhow, Elaine, this has been a real treat for us, getting to meet you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad you like the book.
Yeah, we do. It's so cute. I wanted to get more of these little books.
She has loads of them on all sorts of wonderful countries, France, Italy, and she's also the publisher of the English translation of Pudlow, Paris.
See, I was trying to track that down forever, and I finally realized this last correspondence that's where it's based, Pudlow.
Yep.
We're moving on here. We have some more interviews lined up, so we're going to say goodbye, and I hope that we touch base again with each other.
If you're in New York, I'd love to meet you.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And stay with us while we take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. You're, of course, listening to Ann and Peter Haig at On the Menu Radio, and we're delighted that you're with us. And in our final segment of our program today, we're going to put together what might first seem like a very unusual combination.
Well, they're not, because they're both umami.
They're both umami. They're also America's great favorites in terms of ingredients and things we love to eat.
Chocolate and meat.
Chocolate and meat. Not necessarily in that order, but it is in that order to... The meat lady who's on the end wrote a book about her journey through meat, and the owner and founder of Tazza Chocolate talks first about how he founded his company and what it stands for.
On the Menu gets quite a lot of chocolate, but we're going to be talking to Alex Whitmore, a have Taza chocolate today, and Taza chocolate is Taza, let me make sure I get that straight, is very different. Welcome to On the Menu, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
I think we ought to start by saying, how did you get involved with chocolate making? Because you come from a wholly different background.
Yes, I don't have what you would consider a traditional food manufacturing background. I've always been fascinated by food. I love cooking. My family, we grew up in a very kind of food and meal-oriented household. And my father, in particular, he hoarded dark chocolate all over the place in the freezer.
Really?
In drawers. So he was an avid fan of dark chocolate. And he wasn't too much of a foodie. He just liked to eat the good stuff occasionally. and everything from having Haagen-Dazs chocolate ice cream for breakfast to sneaking little pieces of Lindt dark chocolate bar for an after lunch snack. He was always having some around. So that was some part of it. The other part of my background was basically seeing a business, this company that I worked for a few years before we started Taza Chocolate. I worked for Zipcar, and I got to see a very sort of bold new idea brought to market, and what we thought was kind of a crazy idea at first actually come to fruition and become successful.
These are the cars that you sort of you rent one and you go pick it up on the street, and then when you're done with it, you leave it somewhere.
You bring it right back where you found it. It's basically a self-service on-demand car rental or car sharing.
Okay, so that's a definite segue into making chocolate.
That's definite.
I can see the connection right
well,
there.
Well, the solutions in a way it was, because the solutions we had to solve were very challenging, and chocolate making itself is a very difficult process. Bean-to-bar chocolate manufacturing has many challenges, and it's a very difficult thing to do. So, yeah, it's a totally different industry, but at the same time, the level of challenge is high.
What you're saying is along the way, there are a lot of places where you can make mistakes, where things can go wrong?
Absolutely.
Yes.
There are so many variables when you manufacture a food product, especially chocolate, that cause great challenges.
Now, didn't Mr. Lindt have something? Wasn't there a Mr. Lindt who had something very significant to do with the processing of chocolate?
Yes. Well,
back in history.
That's correct. He is Rudolf Lindt is credited with the development of a process called conching, which is a European process. Actually, one that we do not employ.
I was going to say you don't use
process.
That, do you?
Yeah, we do not conch our chocolate. But he created the conching process, which is basically a mellowing and a refine. It sort of mellows the flavor a little bit, and it also smooths out the consistency.
It makes it shiny
by emulsifying the chocolate mass.
Now we had another guest on the program who said you wouldn't believe what chocolate was like pre-Lindt. I mean, it really wasn't very interesting at all.
Was that Jacques Torres who said that?
I can't remember who it was. It was somebody like a year or so ago, I think. And it's stuck in my mind that it was really interesting, because you think of chocolate as going back through the ages, but it really wasn't like that at all. Now you said very quickly though.
It does go back through the ages.
But it wasn't really all that good.
No, it wasn't in this bar form that the Mayas drank it, right? Yeah.
I would have beef with that statement.
You would have beef with that statement. Go ahead.
Correct this.
Yeah. So the tradition that we base our manufacturing process.
That was what I was going to ask you next.
Yeah, is the Mesoamerican tradition, the American tradition, if you will. So before Europeans ever got their hands on cocoa beans, cocoa beans were indigenous to the Americas, specifically the northern part of South America and Central America. They're originally thought to come from the Amazon basin, but they were really cultivated for the first time in Mesoamerica. So before the Spaniards came over here and brought back food items such as tomatoes, potatoes, chilies, and vanilla beans, and of course cocoa to Europe. The only place in the world where all those food items were consumed were the Americas.
Right.
And so there's a very long tradition of chocolate making and chocolate consumption in the Americas that existed thousands of years before Europe even got their hands on the ingredient to start making.
Who was the Aztec chief that drank chocolate as an aphrodisiac? Who was that?
Well, that was Moctezuma.
Moctezuma, right.
And you know, there's all sorts of legends and lore surrounding his name, and no one knows for sure exactly how, you know, what his cocoa consumption was, but they say it was quite high.
Now, why did you choose to go? Why did you choose to go this way, Alex? I mean, there's a tradition of European style chocolate making that's throughout the United States as well. I mean, some very fine proponents of that. So why did you decide to be different?
Well, take a look out there. Go to your nearest Whole Foods store or specialty food store and look at all the different chocolate out there on the shelf. Now, there's so many chocolate bars and competing chocolate brands and choices out there, and they all, to me, they all look kind of like, wow, those, you know, that group over there is all kind of the same, and this group over here is all kind of the same. And there was a lot of people doing a lot of the same kinds of things, just with different pretty packages on them.
Right.
And one of the things that was inspirational to me was I was a trip that I took to southern Mexico, to the Oaxaca region of Mexico.
Pretty.
And I saw, and the food culture there is incredible. They have a very rich culture of milling and food preparation there. And I saw the way that they consumed and produced chocolate, and that was inspirational to me, and that was the inspiration behind a lot of what we do here at Taza Chocolate.
It was you found a way to differentiate yourself from a really tight market, highly competitive market.
Right.
Chocolate, I mean, it's just exploded. I can't tell you how many books we get of chocolate, how many samples we get of chocolate. Why don't you tell our listeners, I mean, I know what the difference is, but tell our listeners how your chocolate differs from your not run-of-the-mill, because a lot of this high-end chocolate is quite good.
Yes.
But yours is different.
Ours is very different. We manufacture chocolate using only stone mills, and we utilize those stone mills very minimally. So we buy very high-quality ingredients using a practice that we call direct trade. With those ingredients, we very lightly roast the cocoa beans to preserve the integrity of the more delicate flavor characteristics. Then we winnow the beans, and we grind them using traditional Mexican stone mills called molinos. It'll be ground into a paste, what's called cocoa liquor. Then it will be mixed with organic cane sugar for this fabulous organic cane farm in Brazil called the Green Cane Project. That actually uses spent cane fiber to power the mills to make the sugar. It's a very great.
So you're a great company too.
Yeah, and we grind that mixture of the sugar and the cocoa together to make our chocolate. Now, for different chocolate products, we sometimes will grind in other ingredients like chili peppers or vanilla beans or almonds or whatever it is that we grind right through the mill in whole form, and we source all our ingredients using that direct trade practice. But basically, at the end of the process, we've just ground together a few very high quality ingredients. And then deposited it into chocolate bars. So we don't conch, we don't refine, we don't use roller mills or ball mills or anything like that. So we keep kind of the rustic, natural nature of each individual ingredient intact throughout the process.
And that
results in a product that is both very high quality and that it's very simple, and it's also very distinct, and that it's so different from the rest of the European processed chocolate that you see out there.
Oh, it's really for chocolate lovers, is how I would describe it.
Now, you've also got some unique shapes as well, right? I mean, I don't know that there are how many flat round chocolate bars there are, but you have one.
Well, the round discs that we manufacture are traditional, are very traditional Mexican style chocolate, and we wanted to distinguish how they appeared on the shelf from our rectangular chocolate bars, which are a little bit more highly refined. Those are sort of bars of our own design. By shape, we wanted the consumer to be able to be like, oh wow, this is very different looking than this. And in that, there is a tradition for round tablets in Mexico. So the chocolate para mesa, which is table chocolate or drinking chocolate, is oftentimes sold in those round disc forms. So we took design cues from that tradition.
Well, I figured that's probably exactly what you did.
Now tell me, how big are these molinas? I mean, how?
They're not too big. They're the ones that we utilize are probably about 5 feet tall by 5 feet deep and about 4 feet wide.
Uh-huh. Well, that's bigger than
and the
any
stones that the stone grinding elements that are in them are 10 inches in diameter.
So what is your production? How many?
Well, we have a 4,000 square foot facility here in Somerville where we manufacture all of our products from bean to bar.
And Somerville is?
Somerville is in Massachusetts, in New England, in the northeast of the United States.
And
it's very close to Boston. We're in the greater Boston metropolitan area.
And how large a production would you say? I mean, how many bars do you produce?
It depends on the time of year. The fourth quarter, the holiday season is busier for us. But right now we're probably producing about I'd say 8,000 bars a week.
And how do you market these?
They're sold in, we sell directly, for the most part, we sell directly to specialty and natural food stores. We also sell them on our website.
Which is?
Which is www.tazachocolate.com.
That's T-A-Z-A. Chocolate single, because I made an error of an email.
Chocolate is singular, but if you write chocolates, it'll still get you there.
Oh, really? Okay.
And .com. And on that website, there's tons of pictures of our factory. You can see all of our products. There's lots of information about our direct trade practices and also pictures of just about everything from cocoa farms to our factory.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because one of our email exchanges, you said, I'm visiting some of our cocoa farmers the first 2 weeks in April. So you go out in the field and visit these farms.
Yes.
And where were they? And what are these people like?
That's a great question. Well, we part of our business is this direct trade model. So we only buy ingredients directly from farms. We don't buy it from brokers or from ingredient houses or anything like that. We buy from farms. So to do that, we have to cultivate a good relationship with a farm. And to get the high quality that we demand, we need to have a very good relationship with a farmer, which means we pay more than everyone else for only the cream of the crop, the best ingredients they can provide. And we also have a good personal relationship. And to do that, we actually need to visit them. We need to make trips and cultivate relationships. A lot of our business is inspired by the principles of slow food. I don't know how familiar you are with
that
organization.
We're members, yeah.
But a lot of our practices are based upon that. Everything from our minimal processing, our using only the best ingredients to make a very simply made, simply prepared food, all the way up to how we do business and how we trade is based on those slow food principles of good, clean, and fair.
Yeah, this is the next thing, direct trade. It's the current thing, not fair trade. Beyond that, direct trade.
It's beyond direct trade. Is beyond fair trade.
Right, I agree.
So that visiting the farms is something that we love to do, as well as something that we need to do to practice business the way we do.
Now, when we visit them, I was going to say, are these people impoverished, like some of these vanilla farmers?
Well, the vanilla farm in our situation, we get all our vanilla from this farm called Via Vanilla in Costa Rica. They have a website. You can find that on our website at tazachocolate.com. All that information is there. You can see pictures of the farm. They are not impoverished. They're more well-to-do. They're actually doing very well right now. Their business is booming. The cocoa farmers, on the other hand, some of them are impoverished. And one of the things that we try to do when we visit our farmers, for instance, in the Dominican Republic, is we offer them a way out of that. Most of these farms are ending up having to sell a lot of their bean to what's called coyotes, which are people that go around and buy beans in advance at a much lower price because the farmers need money so badly.
Uh-huh.
So they sell their beans off at a much lower price than the market will normally offer in advance of when they have them, because they need the money. So what we try to do is we try to make or get them payments in advance, much like the fair trade model utilizes, for that, and then we pay them a quality premium above the organic and the fair trade premium. So they're getting paid at least 15%, oftentimes much more, above the fair trade price and the organic price for very high quality beans. So in a way, what we provide is a solution to the impoverished system that they're existing under.
Wow, you are just amazing. I mean, I've learned so much just talking to you. You're going to join the short list of people I'd like to have a really long dinner with.
Well, thank you kindly, Anne. I hope we can do that sometime.
And we would undoubtedly have chocolate for dessert. And thank you so much, Alec, for joining us today and telling us the story. listeners, the short answer to this is get some of this. Get some of this. It's really good.
And just look at this website, because TazaChocolate.com, because it's just, you learn more than you ever thought you didn't know.
Well, thanks for having me, Ann and Peter.
Thank you, Alex, and hopefully we'll see you at the Fancy Food Show in the summer.
That sounds great. I hope to see you there.
Yeah, I will. Okay, thanks, Alex.
Take care.
Bye. We're talking to Susan Barrett. Welcome, Susan, to On the Menu.
Thanks so much for having me.
Susan is a journalist, a magazine journalist, and I admitted to her before coming on the air here that in her book called Meat, A Love Story, Pasture to Plate, A Search for the Perfect Meal, I almost didn't get past the first paragraph. Or the first chapter. Susan, you know why, and why don't you tell our listeners?
Okay. Well,
first of all, preface it by what your point is.
Well, the point of the book is, I think it really is sort of a celebration of meat and an exploration of what meat means to us in our culture. You know, what are the sort of social and cultural symbols that we're consuming when we eat meat? I really set out to find out why we're so obsessed with meat in North America. And as you mentioned, the first chapter was a bit of something, I guess, that's tough to read.
I think it would be tough to experience. I can't imagine. I know how dedicated journalists can be, but I would never, ever put myself in a slaughterhouse like that.
Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. It seemed like a great story idea. And I must say I had real reservations the first day I took I hadn't actually set out to write a food book, and I hadn't set out to write a book. It just sort of evolved. And the backdrop really was I had set out to work in a slaughterhouse to try to understand what it was about what I like to call big meat. Why the sort of industrial meat complex can never find people to do the jobs. They were once really high-paying jobs. In fact, the meat industry kind of set the tone for the whole industrial model for unionization. And those jobs were once really safe, relatively safe, high-paying jobs. And now workers get paid minimum wage here in Canada, and certainly we've heard a lot about this in the U.S. too. So I wanted to find out what was it about this work that was so horrible that we have to bring in temporary farm workers. So this was a few years ago, and it was my job. I got hired.
You were undercover.
Pardon?
You were undercover.
I was undercover. I went undercover, and clearly no meat processor is going to want a journalist on the factory floor. So I went. I got a job working in the byproducts part of the plant, where it was my duty to chop the cheeks out of hogs' heads. Well, let's just say, you know, the unexpected upshot was that after 4 days, I walked off the factory floor vowing I was never going to eat meat again. And it really set me on this journey.
Okay, so your journey was in search of?
I stopped eating meat. This was another attempt at vegetarianism. I've dabbled on and off with vegetarianism throughout most of my adult life. But this time, I was really convinced that, first of all, I didn't want to have anything to do with meat that was produced in that way. I didn't like the exploitation of workers. And like a lot of people, I was really concerned about pathogens. We have these huge meat recalls all of the time. And so I was going to do vegetarianism like a scientist. And really, after several weeks, I found I had a craving for meat, and it's something that a controversial anthropologist claims is what we call meat hunger. It's what he calls meat hunger. And he says that every act in human history is really to secure a steady supply of protein. And I found I also had this meat hunger, and I wondered after having this terrible, horrifying experience, why would I want to eat meat again? But I did. And so that's what set me out on this journey, really across North America, to find the perfect meat and meat that I could feel comfortable eating.
And what did you land on as the answer?
Well, journey took me from, I went whale hunting with the Inupiaq.
Oh, that was funny. Yeah, that was amazing.
It was really a magical experience. And I think in a lot of ways, I learned so much about the celebration of meat that in their culture that really still exists in the rest of North American culture. And what I found was that, you know, when they're celebrating around, you know, the blood-spattered whale on the ice floe and everybody's getting in line for a piece of muktuk or whale blubber, that really it isn't that different than what we're doing when we go to the steakhouse or what we're doing when we gather around the barbecue. It really is, I think, a celebration of life.
Now, you also went off in search of animals that had been were cared for a little nicer than the ones in the factories.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, these are very, you know, as I said, this isn't a polemic or a manifesto, but I really set out to find meat that I could feel confident eating and eat with a clear conscience. So I guess I did come to my own personal conclusion, which is that we do need to eat less meat. We need to eat meat that we can feel confident eating, which is...
In other words, by that you mean meat that we know the source of, so,
exactly.
So we know that it's less likely to have problems. Is that what you mean?
Exactly.
Because we continued to eat beef throughout the mad cow episode in the United Kingdom, which we visit regularly, because my mother said, no, I don't have to worry about it because I know where the meat comes from. I know what farmer it comes from, and I know that this is not the way he would feed his livestock. So I feel like the ultimate traceability existed at the very small producer level. And is that's what you found here too, I'm guessing, as well.
Yes. That's right. I mean, I do. We're all concerned about pathogens, and just this recent outbreak of swine flu, I was reminded of one professor that I interviewed very early in my research, who really predicts that you know, there is a coming meat apocalypse, and that in 100 years, meat eating is really just going to be a historical footnote.
That's interesting.
Because we've wiped out biodiversity. And so unless we change how we raise our animals, we won't be able to eat meat.
Susan, I can't resist asking you. I'm thinking publication dates. I mean, this is a new book out, but you wrote it, like, what, 2 years ago?
Yes.
And so you must by now have moved on to other projects. What was your next project after this?
Well, in terms of a new book or...
Sure. I mean, or what you've turned your research to, because you really do thorough research.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really, it's interesting. It's really sort of pushed me more in the direction of health. And so I've been working on a number of health-related projects since I've done this book.
Yeah. Well, you've had a lot of interesting adventures in it, and I think that's part of what the readers are going to enjoy about this, along with the fact that it's a reprisal of something that we're all facing right now as an issue. The book is Meat, a Love Story, which I thought was very nice to subtitle it that too. And the author is Susan Barrett. And Susan, keep in touch with us.
Well, thank you so much.
And, and keep turning out the books.
Yeah, and thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
And thank you for sharing your journey. It seems to me, this is a very interesting book because it seems that you have one idea when you start and then you have another idea in the middle and then you're smart enough to change your mind all the way through as you find out more information. I think that's always a great thing to do. So we thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
And your writing is very lucid, so I think people are going to find it a really inspirational book as well.
Oh, I hope so.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Ode
to the Steakhouse. I love it. Okay. And also with a great sense of humor here. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've covered a lot of territory, and I think that's going to wrap it for this week.
Yeah, you actually had a bonus. Turned out to be quite a long program, but a fascinating one, and we hope, of course, you'll join us again. Same time.
Same
place. Next week.
Bye-bye.